Excuse me, is this the reading room?
I'm Saad Manzoor.
And I'm Travis Howard.
Welcome to Reading Room Talk. Thank you for pressing play. We have struck gold.
Yes, we did. We're so happy to be here.
Yes, we are here with Dr. Coleman.
Yes, the legendary.
There's no words. There's no words. We really, really appreciate you allowing us to be here with you today. We're looking forward to hearing all of your stories about everything you've been through. So the first question I'm going to ask you is, take us back to medical school. What was your toughest class or rotation in medical school?
Okay, that's an easy one. I would say surgery and mass general.
Okay.
And the reason I say that is surgeons are always up early. OR opens early, and the cases tend to occur at the crack of dawn. Mm-hmm. And I was living in Vanderbilt Hall. Mm-hmm. And as you know, Mass General is a distance from there. So my routine was to grab the train. And unfortunately, my surgery rotation was during the winter. So we had this huge storm. Mm. And it was an ice storm, snowstorm, and I got up as usual, walked to the MTA, and I stood there in the cold.
What time was
it? The train wasn't coming.
Oh.
Like, it was in the dark.
Oh, yeah.
Okay? And you know, this was before cell phones and information that told you what was going on at the train. And I wasn't the only person standing there. But we were standing there waiting for the train, and it was obvious that there was something really wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at my watch and checking the time. Then I started to cry, and I'm not a crier. So that was very traumatic.
Because, you know, if you were late,
yes,
it was going to be a
that's
problem.
That's right, because they didn't want you late for surgery rotation, and I was the only person of color on the surgery rotation.
Oh.
That was another issue.
Mm-hmm. Extra pressure.
And my husband, who I'm married to this day, mm-hmm. Is a dentist.
Okay.
And he had a little blue Volkswagen Beetle, okay? And basically, I called him up, and he was like, "What is going on? You're crying." It was, you know, like I said, it was cracking dawn in the morning. It wasn't even dawn yet. It was dark. And he had, in the old days, they had these little sprays where you sprayed a lock, because the lock on his car was frozen.
We were freezing. Oh,
outside.
Yeah, it's cold.
Yeah. So he grabbed his coat. He grabbed his spray. He sprayed the lock. The old bug started up because it was used from a cousin of his.
Wow.
And he came and picked me up at the station where I was standing there right at the corner and got me to the surgery rotation.
Wow. Hall.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And I was able to get in there, dry my tears, get out of these frozen clothes, get on my white coat, and get in line for the rounds. You know, they make the rounds, and they're
mm-hmm.
standing there, and they ask me, well, what about Miss So-and-so? Da, 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 da.
Mm-hmm.
So I made it. So that I considered my toughest rotation of all.
Wow.
Because of the time of the morning, the time of the year.
Yeah, in Boston, it's like dark.
And yes, and the hours.
Yeah.
In other words, it's not like radiology in the sense that, you know, I would know when I was on call. I would know when I had to do nights or weekends or
right.
whatever. Surgery is like you go at the crack of dawn in the morning and you stay till the work gets done.
Period.
And that's right. Mm-hmm. And it may be 12 hours, 20 hours, 48 hours, or whatever it is. That's it. So, and also surgery was one of the rotations where I lost my first patient. So that was
that's
traumatic.
Tough. Wow.
Yes. And they made it my job to be with him, hold his hand, talk to him, and do all this stuff. And he knew he was going. I knew he was going.
Yeah.
And it was really traumatic. But all in all, when I think about everything, that was a toughie.
Wow.
But I survived it
because
I'm a fighter.
Yeah.
Right.
And I just
right.
kept on moving.
Yeah.
I said, no matter what they do, I'm getting through this rotation, and I got to beat, which was good enough for me.
A B at MGH.
Yeah.
That's an A anywhere else.
That's right. Exactly. At MGH, that's right. That's the way I looked at it.
That's okay. Absolutely right.
Okay.
So, Dr. Comer, how did you make it? Well, what do you think helped you the most?
I think it was my drive and my stamina because, you know, coming along, nobody in my family had ever been a doctor. That's the first thing.
Wow.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was at Vassar College and I said I wanted to go to medical school, one of my faculty members said to me, why do you want to go to medical school? Why don't you just be a nurse? I knew, okay.
Common story.
That's right. In the 70s now. Right. I graduated out of the class of 1970, but, you know, from 66 to 70, she made that comment to me.
Wow.
And I said, what? And I wanted to say to her, well, what is the major difference? Mm-hmm. The nurses assist the physicians. They're both working towards the regards of the patient
right. And
so forth. But why not aim for the top?
Yeah.
And
exactly.
So it was not a simple choice. I didn't have anyone to, you know, ahead of me in the family as a guide
right.
as to what to do or anything. I just said, this is what I want to do. And it's a long story, you starting me at medical school, but I can tell you the story about why I wanted to be a doctor.
Please
oh,
do.
Yes,
a long
no,
story.
Take us back.
Okay.
That's what we're here
but,
for.
But my mom had two sets of kids in groups of three. So the first three, I was a year behind my older brother, and mm-hmm. then I had a younger brother that was 2 years behind me. And the three of us were very close
okay.
before the second three came along. And in high school, my older brother, the one that I told you about starting the Commodores, he was a football player.
Okay.
And I was a majorette in the band, Michael Gilbert.
Michael Gilbert.
You could probably look him up. But he had an injury.
Okay.
And dislocated a shoulder. And the coach, as is in a lot of schools and even now, mm-hmm. He popped it back in.
The coach did?
But, yes, the coach did. Because we had one orthopedic surgeon in our small town.
And where was
and
the small town?
And he was Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
Uh-huh. Martha Mitchell put Pine Bluff, Arkansas on the map because she was the wife of Attorney General John Mitchell.
Oh, I see. Okay.
But be that as it may, and she was a character. But it was a small country town in the South.
Okay.
And we had one Caucasian orthopedic surgeon, and he was on a fishing trip. So my mom said that, okay, you're going to be his nurse. And my two brothers had bunk beds. So
okay.
we came up with the bright idea, not knowing anything about medicine, because we could see that the shoulder was getting swollen and the
right.
tissues were getting sort of distorted and ugly looking.
Mm-hmm.
So we put him on the bottom of the bunk and tied his arm up to the bottom of the mattress under the top bunk to sort of like
that's pretty
not
good.
Knowing anything about medicine, yeah. thinking that maybe the fluid would go back the other way.
I swear.
And I had to feed him and change his bandage
wow.
and care for him until the orthopedic surgeon came back that Monday.
From his fishing trip.
Yeah, from his fishing trip.
Yes.
He fixed everything, took care of everything, and my brother was fine thereafter. But I said, how could we just have one specialist in this town
yeah,
that
right.
would know how to do something like that when we have multiple high schools?
Right.
We have kids playing all kinds of sports,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
from basketball to football to whatever, and injuries are prevalent, as you might know. So, but anyway, to be that as it may, I made a determination then that I was going to do medical school, and people say, mm-hmm.
And how old were you at this point?
I was maybe
eighth grade,
okay. something like that.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then as time progressed, when I was in high school, it was after Brown versus Board of Education, which you guys know
mm-hmm.
came about in 1954. I graduated from Merrill High School, Pine Bluff, Arkansas in 1966, which was 12 years after Brown went through.
Yeah.
And still, it was totally segregated.
It's still down south.
Okay.
Yes.
So I could tell that my textbooks had been used because they were written in. And,
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
areas were underlined or starred that were important. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
And the kids across town, they had the brand new textbooks. Mm. And we took the next edition that they didn't have. Also, you would see, you know, in our bio labs and things
mm-hmm.
like that, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 of us would be gathered around one microscope.
Right.
Across town, each
yeah.
kid had their own microscope.
How
okay?
did you have that reference? Did you know people across town? Or
no,
like,
eventually, I asked, because I was
okay.
always an inquisitive person, and my mom was an educator. She
oh,
was a teacher herself.
Okay. Gotcha.
In elementary school, and again, it was strictly segregated, but there was often communication or people would tell. Okay. Oh, yeah. In other words, we weren't allowed to even drive anywhere near their school or even in the neighborhood. But it's hard to hide information, so data would get out and people would find things out. So they knew what kind of situation we were in. They had their own pond where they could investigate algae and biology things. And that we had the ravine in a swamp, you know, that we walked across. It had, you know, moccasins and things like that that could kill you. That's what we had. But we learned and we were informed later. When we were going through it at the time, you did not always know what you had and what they had. But if you were smart enough, you could surmise.
You figure it out.
You knew that someone had used your textbook.
Yeah, the used book is coming from somewhere.
When you got dog ears, everything like that. And you knew that we didn't even have two kids to share a microscope. I mean, it's virtually impossible to have 5, 6, 7, 8 kids around one lens. You can imagine.
Do you see it? Yeah.
And you get tested on it.
And to know that Brown had basically stricken, you know, segregation, but the South was very slow to respond. Very slow to respond.
So you knew all of that. Yeah.
Yes, I knew all of that. And I started in my career because even after Brown came out, the National Presbyterian Church from New York City, and I say that they decided they were going to do an experiment, but they had a program and it was called SSSP or something like that. And basically they went through the South and they were testing the theory about separate but equal. It was never equal. It was always separate, but they were testing the theory. So what they did was they went through all of the high schools that were segregated in Southern states.
Okay.
So Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, Georgia, Tennessee,
Alabama,
Florida, across. And what they did was they tested the students, and they took the one female and the one male who scored highest on their test. And they offered us a summer sort of like internship camp situation where we went to Knoxville College. University of Tennessee, now it's called University of Tennessee, but Knoxville College, and it was segregated back at that time. And they had teachers from New York City and the Presbyterian Church who came down and taught us concentrated math and English reading skills. And then and we got tested at the end of every week, and everybody who did well, you got a treat. We had dinners where we had to dress up. The guys had to put on jackets. They did the whole thing. Manners and, you know, the whole thing. And if we completed the program successfully after the end of the 6 weeks or so, we were treated to a trip. So one year we got on the bus and went to New York City. Another year we went to, you know, Disneyland, Disney World.
Oh, that's pretty fun.
Those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay.
But when the program was over, what was supposed to happen was we were supposed to apply to Seven Sisters schools and the Ivy League and things like that in order to integrate the schools.
I see.
Okay. And
so you kind of groomed for it, I guess. That program.
The program first, and my high school was an excellent school, and I have to say that the teachers really cared about the students. And I mean, we the mayor of our city eventually was a graduate of our high school.
Okay.
We had concert pianists and opera stars and all of that that came out of that school.
Wow. Okay.
But I think I was the first MD to come out of that school. But
what was the name of the school?
Merrill High School, Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
It
has a storied history in the state of Arkansas. But be that as it may, when you finish your few years of summer programs, I think I did it maybe twice. When you got into your senior year, you were supposed to fill out these applications to go to places.
To schools.
In the Northeast. Basically, all of them were. And so they sent the information to our guidance counselor, and she talked down to my parents, and she said, oh, this is pie in the sky. It's not really realistic. You need to go apply to Howland and Fisk, which I did do. Yeah. Applied to Howland and Fisk. I got into both of those. Mm-hmm. And my mom had one sister with two girls, and my cousin that was the same age as I was, she ended up going to Fisk and graduating from Fisk.
Okay.
But be that as it may, the Presbyterian Church reviewed all of their records. And so they called down to the high school and they said, "What happened to the Gilbert girl?"
Oh, wow.
That was me. "What, we don't have her paperwork. What are you doing? Da 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 da." So then they pulled me out of class, and the counselor was getting all upset, and my mom was trying to explain that she told us that this wasn't worthwhile, we should be doing this and anything. Anyway, the bottom line is they said, "Look, it is not too late. It's only too late for one school, Radcliffe College."
Okay.
So anything else on here, oh, you wow. can apply to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And at the time, JFK was our president.
Okay.
So,
okay.
And I knew that Jackie had gone to Vassar. So I said, "Okay, wow. I'm gonna do Vassar."
Awesome.
Okay,
that's great.
And then I did Mount Holyoke.
Okay.
Yeah, and basically, everyone I did, I got into.
Nice.
And when I got into Vassar, I said, "Because she went there, I'm going there."
That's so funny.
And so, and that is the story of how I got there.
How you got there.
And, you know, of course, I was a full scholarship student. My uncle was a minister. My mom's sister, one sister was married to a minister. And he had funds and things. So he would, you know, we got to go to New York City as a family when she graduated from Columbia. And, you know,
okay.
see the Empire State Building and all of these.
Far away from Pine Bluff,
Arkansas. But he let me travel with them some. So because she had two girls, and one of them was the exact same age as me, and we were almost about the same size, they would dress us like triplets. And of course, my uncle's buying the clothes and everything. And when I was in Knoxville, she would send me these big boxes of clothes and food and snacks and things to eat. But make the point, long story short, that's how I ended up in Vassar College. Now, once I got to Vassar College, you can imagine that was a different, totally different environment.
Had you visited before you went? Or?
No.
Oh, wow.
I didn't have the money to go visit. Mm. They just said, "Which of these schools do you want to apply to?" That was it.
Yeah.
Jackie O's school.
My uncle flew me up there. He took me to campus. My very best friend from Vassar now, she's a PhD in Atlanta, Georgia, and my one godson is a director at Morehouse. He's the head of the psych department and all that. He gives TED Talks and things like that.
Okay.
But
what's his name?
David Ball Rice.
Okay.
A PhD at Morehouse, head of psych department, and has some other big titles. But be that as it may, I met her the very first day I got there. And this was the first class at Vassar where they had more than one or two black girls, women of color. Okay,
yeah.
So in our class, I think there was maybe 10 of us. And we were scattered from all across the United States. So like Kansas City, my best friend was from Virginia.
Okay.
There
okay.
was a girl from Chicago. Maybelle was from Baltimore.
That's
so,
cool.
You know, we had everything from the little country towns to the big city ghettos, you know, the whole works.
So how is that meeting, like seeing another, you know, black person at Vassar?
We were the rebels because, again, this was 1966.
Yeah.
So our class was the class that sat in at the main campus, you know. And we made a lot of changes there. And but it was a totally different environment. And it was like, you know, being a big fish in a little pond and then going to a giant ocean.
Yeah.
Because everybody there was valedictorian or straight A students. Yeah. What did they care about 4 point something plus from Pine Bluff, Arkansas?
Yeah.
As opposed to, but at any rate, that I kept that dream about being a doctor. And so I would, you know, because I was a scholarship student, I was expected to have a work thing. So I worked in the biology labs, cleaning out the rat trays and the mice and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I took all my required courses, like, you know, you had to take physics, you had to take chemistry, you had, you know, they have these things to discourage you along the way.
I'm
like, when did I ever use physics in radiology?
I'm telling you.
I mean, I used my physics, but not what they were talking and biochem and some of these other things.
So right. true.
But it's the so be, true. Be that as it may, I did all that. And as you can imagine, people applied to Harvard Medical School other than me. Mm-hmm. So it was a huge disappointment in the class.
Yeah.
When I got in and some other people who had higher grade point averages didn't get in.
Oh.
Because this was in the day when Harvard, mm-hmm. it was, you know, it was before King was assassinated. Because he was assassinated when I was at Baxter, because I remember being in a library there. So, you know, a lot of the schools, you just, people were just walking through the hallways here. And I was studying. I'll never forget it. I was in the main library. But Harvard got it in their mind that we have to do a better job.
Okay.
And so they set out to have Dr. Alvin Poussin, who retired a couple of years ago, and you can look him up. Mm-hmm. He was a person that was supposed to watch over these black kids. Because, you know, my husband was at the dental school in the class of 73. Mm-hmm. And they had one black female in their class and then a number of males.
Okay.
And then when my class came along, the class of 74, there was like 6, 7, 8 of us. So a few girls from Spelman, there was me, there was another girl from, you know, New York City, Bryn Mawr, someplace like that. So it was an experiment by the school,
mm-hmm.
and we all talked about it and we knew it. So we knew we had to do well.
You had to do well.
And so we studied and we worked and we passed test after test after test. And we did everything we had to do to get out of there.
Right.
And it was a come down because, you know, again, you were the superstar at your high school were a good student at your college, but this is a whole nother level.
Different
So I didn't even care if I got a C in something in medical school. The important thing was that I wanted to finish every class, every rotation, do the very best that I could. And then I was going to go into some kind of residency internship program.
That's great.
And back in the day, they felt that women should be either in OBGYN or pediatrics. Mm-hmm. You guys know this story by now. And so I said, okay, I'll do pediatrics. I'll do the kids. And I had a pediatric rotation at Boston Children's where I was seeing every kind of sarcoma known to man. And it was depressing. I had one guy put his fist through the wall by my head because I was taking care of his child that already had an enucleation of one eye for retinoblastoma. Uh-huh. So it was a very, and I was seeing different sides of pediatrics. But they said, if you're sure you want to do pediatrics, why don't you go into some specialties related to pediatrics? So I went into pediatric radiology.
Oh, interesting.
And that's when it hit.
Yes.
Because this was back when everything was on film.
Yeah.
You remember? So you would take a break for 10 to 15 minutes and the aides would come out and they would load all the black films and you would push your foot on the button and the Rolodex would go around and all the x-rays would pop up and everybody was coming to the radiologist to figure out what to do next.
Yeah.
Is this lung cancer? Is it pneumonia? What segment is it? Is it the gallbladder? Is it the pancreas? Is it the liver? I mean, this was back in the day. I said, these people are really smart. They are directing the management, even though they may not be touching the patient right now, right this moment. These people are drivers. They are movers and shakers of what's happening with these patients because the surgeon doesn't know where to cut. They don't know what to do. They don't know what antibiotic to give. They don't know if this is a virus, a bacteria. Da, da, da. So I said, I like this stuff. So then I did that one. And then I did another one, I think, at New England Deaconess. And then I said, I'm going to do this. And there were very few of us who came out of my class that said that they were going to do radiology. One other black guy and me, and then, you know, a couple of them. And then I was determined to do it. And so, you know, what do you do? You apply to programs, and I got into Penn.
Wonderful. Great program.
The rest is story.
Yeah.
And the way it started out, though, is when I met my husband. I told you about everything that happened to my husband. We married when I was in my senior year of medical school and he had graduated. and he started dentistry because he was from Detroit. He started dentistry at the University of Michigan.
Okay.
So when I applied to radiology, I got into Michigan and I was there with him. Oh, but then we hit this snag because my mother-in-law was driving me crazy. And she would come up from Detroit with her little tennis skirt on. And I had been in the hospital for two nights in a row because Michigan had Jackson Prison and all of that. Yeah. And this was back in the day when, you know, you had to, you know, they weren't interested in, you know, your cognitive abilities and too much stress and your eyesight. So, you know, you would come in early one morning, mm-hmm. you would stay all night, you work all the next day. And then if you're lucky, maybe you go home that next day.
Wow.
So she showed up on our doorstep in her tennis skirt when I had been post-call. And I was like, okay, this is it. We are not going to last here. We got to get out of here. And my husband had a friend, a dental friend, who was from this area.
Okay.
And
okay.
he was at Penn Dental School.
Gotcha.
So he told him, he said, man, you need to come here. We need some more people here, da-da-da-da-da, that look like us, and blah, blah, blah. And so I applied. And as it turns out, the radiology department at Penn, the residents were upset and getting ready to strike because they had too much work and they were going crazy and everything. And really? They were like, this is nuts. This. And this was back in the day when Penn was not an academic department. It was owned, okay, by this guy as like a private practice and everything. So it was a mess. And then Stanley Baum eventually came in from Mass General and turned it into an academic department. But they needed more resident help because the residents were saying that they were making mistakes and the call was too just horrific and everything. So I interviewed and one of the best teachers there, Dr. Wally Miller Jr., he asked me, what did I think about the Black Panthers in my interview?
Oh, my gosh.
To
really?
Show you where we were back then, okay? Now, we are now in the 70s. Okay?
How'd you get out of that?
So, I don't even remember what I told him. But you know what? I gave him this look, and I just kept on moving. And I said, you don't have to worry, because I am not going to start a revolution here. And then when they accepted me and I came in, you know, I passed by one bulletin board, and there was a notice that says, let the new girl do it. So it was that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. But I just said, okay, you know, I got this. We're going to do
it.
Yeah,
that's
right.
You
got
it.
Yeah. And so I did a phenomenal job. And when Dr. Baum came from Mass General, you know, they kept it a secret. I didn't hear about it, but they had a big debate about who was going to be the chief resident.
No.
Because he wanted me. Because I came from Harvard, and the older people that were there said that she didn't start with this class. She came in the middle of the first year after 6 months.
Yeah.
She shouldn't be the chief resident, da-da-da-da-da. So they made one of my friends, a white male, John Bonavita, you know, but the vote came down between the two of us, and the older people said that he started the class, and I didn't, and I was like, you know, coming in the middle, so he should be it. So he was a chief resident. He went into private practice to get a lot more money at Chester Crozier.
Oh, wow.
And he stayed in private practice, and then he eventually moved to New York City. I stayed in academics, and I'm the professor.
I'm the person who
lectures internationally and does all this stuff. And,
exactly.
and Dr. Baum and I are still friends.
Oh,
yeah,
that's
he
really
lives
good.
Out
that's
in
great.
Chestnut Hill to this day. But secrets are hard to keep in radiology
absolutely.
Or in medicine in general.
It's a small world.
It is a small world. And what you see on television, on these medical shows, it is exactly what happens. And the truth will eventually come to light. So,
Dr. Comer, how did you... So, you know, I want to go back to a time where you were just an academic all-star. What do you attribute that to? I know your mom was an educator.
Yes.
But it seems like you... Education and academics were a breeze for you.
Well, in the sense that, you can look at academics from a number of ways. My older brother had the highest IQ for a while, and the one that did the Commodores. He could he could see some electronic and just, but but he was not a worker. Mm-hmm. And then in the younger three, I have a sister who had an IQ of 160. So she had to hire of the younger three.
Yeah.
And again, she has not necessarily lived up to all of her potential. She has a couple of masters, but she could have done a lot more. But mm-hmm. I was the one that had the drive to say that I want to do something that has never been done before in the family.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, as it turns out, I told you my mom was just inseparable from her one sister, my aunt.
Mm-hmm.
And my aunt had two girls, and my grandmother was an identical twin girl. So of the three of us, me and my two cousins, they said, okay, one of these girls will have twin girls. So my younger cousin had identical twin girls. And one of them is a pediatrician in North Carolina.
Wow.
Okay.
And so there's now somebody else in the family. And then the other one is an architect in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
We have always been brainy.
Yeah.
Okay. My grandfather owned a dinette. That's what it was called back in the day. You guys would probably call it a college diner now.
Okay. In Pine Bluff.
Way back in Pine Bluff, Arkansas. And
okay.
He moved to Pine Bluff, Arkansas, which was a college town. That's mm-hmm. where the college was
yeah.
for black kids, because he said that he was not an educated man, but he wanted his two daughters to be educated.
Wow.
So he lived in a smaller town, West Helena, Arkansas.
Okay.
And he moved to Pine Bluff. And he opened this diner on the college campus.
Hmm.
And all of his clientele were the students, the professors, and all of that. And, you know, when he died, they, you know, there were all these testimonials mm-hmm. about, you know, Mr. Eli fed me even when I didn't have the money for lunch or dinner.
Wow.
Yeah, he could tell. He knew what the students were going through, and he would give them food way back in the day. If they were hungry,
wow.
and kids were hungry back in the day.
Yeah.
Anyway, to make a long story short, my mom and my aunt both got their undergraduate degrees from AM&N College. It was called Agricultural, Mechanical, and Normal College. It is now called, it's a branch of the University of Arkansas.
Oh,
and the main okay. campus of the University of Arkansas is in Fayetteville.
Yeah.
So my mom went there. So my mom walked across the stage with her college degree in 1948 when she was pregnant with me.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was born in August. So you know she was a toughie.
Yes.
And I tell them, I said, I think my granddaughter is reincarnated from her, because my daughter named her Carrie, and I swear she's going to be a toughie.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But oh, my wow. mom was like, if you told her you couldn't do it, then that just made her that
about to get
crazier.
Done.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, we lived in this very segregated town. The post office said that they had not a single black person who could pass the examination, you know.
To become a post office worker?
Yeah. To be,
wow.
You remember the federal exam.
Yeah.
And they said that, and she said, this is crap. This doesn't make sense. I know my daughter could pass the
right.
exam. And I did, with flying colors. And, you know, she... Still, you know, you hope for the best. I was like all of 80 pounds soaking wet. And she thought they were going to give me a job at the stamp window. Okay. They offered me a 250-pound backpack.
Oh, geez.
Okay. To walk outside. And uh-huh. And
yes.
she said, oh, no, she's not doing that.
But
we proved that we could pass the exam.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
The federal qualified exam. And that's what a lot of all of that was about. But my grandfather was determined that his daughters get educated. So my mom got her master's degree, and she was from the large Caucasian university. So
yeah,
she
went through it.
Mm-hmm, and yeah. she was a special education teacher. And my aunt got her master's degree from Columbia University in New York City.
Wow.
And eventually got a PhD, I don't remember where, but she was the first Montessori principal in the state of Tennessee.
Oh, really?
White or black.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they always were heavy into education, and neither my grandmother or my grandfather on my mother's side had a formal education, but they were determined that their daughters would be educated.
They put them in that environment.
And so
yeah.
then, from then on, their daughter's children, all of us, have, you
there's
know,
a legacy
had,
of being
yeah.
educated.
All of us do something. Yeah.
Wow.
And all of us have college degrees or higher degrees and things like that. And I told you about my niece that's a pediatrician in North Carolina. So that everybody just kept on doing and normal things, but then things that we thought were really important. My grandmother's, again, on my mother's side, she was the one who was married to the guy who opened the dinette. Mm-hmm. He got his PhD from Cornell in agriculture.
Oh, wow.
Way back in the 40s. One of the first, and he was working at this college campus. So when my niece got her PhD, when she got her master's, she looked up his degree at Cornell when she got her master's in architecture. Yeah, she said, I'm going to look up Uncle Celis' degree. And it's in the archives.
Really?
So, yeah. So we had people who were very interested in higher education in our family. And our family kept pushing that. Yeah. And I will say right now to my daughter, Malcolm X says, education is the key. Mm-hmm.
Okay,
they fear an educated black man or woman. Mm-hmm. Okay, some people still do.
Yeah.
And if we get that education, they can't hold you but so far back.
Yeah,
all this information about the tremendous wealth gap that we still have not overcome.
Right.
And all of that, that is overcome with education.
Absolutely.
So,
that's one of the biggest determinants.
Really critical to push that. Yeah. And when we were supposed to have three kids, we had one. We learned early on that she couldn't stand the sight of blood. So we said, okay, medical school's out, dental school's out. She said, what about dental school? She said, that's just bloody teeth.
Yeah.
What about veterinary school? I like animals. That's just blood with animals. So we were trying to figure out what in the world was she going to do because she was more verbal than scientific.
Okay.
And my younger sister got her undergraduate degree from Brown. And when she graduated, because we were up here on the East Coast. You know, my parents would bring up here. We would take her to school. And my daughter was like, you know, 4 or 5 elementary school. She would go there. When my sister graduated, she met the president of Brown. She said, oh, I want to go to this school.
Done.
We said, you have to be really smart to get into this school. But to make a long story short, we lived in New Jersey for a long time. So we, because I was away from home a lot, my husband was away from home a lot, my daughter was in the Quaker system. So she started at age 4 at Morristown Friends School and went to graduation. She got into Brown. Mm-hmm. She revived the African Sun, which was the black newspaper, which was going down under.
Okay.
And she was a DJ on the black radio there, got that rev back up. Then she went to Columbia School of Journalism.
Oh, wow.
And she got her master's in journalism. Mm-hmm. And she is a television news anchor here in Philadelphia, in NBC 10. She does the news from 4 to 7 every morning.
Yeah.
She makes almost as much money as I do.
Oh, that's so
we
good.
Both had to take pay cuts for COVID, but she has a
big
six-figure salary. But we knew that she wasn't going to be a medical student. So we said, what is your forte? What are you really good at? And she's very verbal like me.
Mm-hmm.
And we had nobody in the family in journalism.
All right.
So we said, okay, we can start a new career.
Yeah.
Something new and different. So her kids, whenever they feel like it, they can wake up in the morning and see mommy on TV and they just blase.
Exactly.
Oh, it's mommy. We're not paying any attention, blah, 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 blah. But we have to enforce that education is the key.
Yeah, I agree with you. So your challenge on your journey to be as educated as you are as an African-American female, how did you do it? Let's talk about some of those obstacles you had to get. You kind of touched on several of them already.
There are so many.
Yeah.
But I told you, they just keep coming.
Yeah.
You know, you think to yourself, okay, when is this ever going to end?
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
And you realize that people need to see you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, you know, when I go down to the cafeteria, hi, Dr. Cole, it's always been the case.
Mm-hmm.
How you doing? Da da da. I don't care if they got a mop or a broom. I'm walking by. Good morning. How's your day going? Everybody knew
Absolutely.
Me. When I first got the pin, they were so proud of me. Now, when we first started, they would see me along with the white guys, and they weren't sure what was happening.
Yes.
Okay, so the first time I went through the lunch line, I had a black cashier, and it was like she didn't want to serve me. And she had this frown on her face and everything, and I was with the guys. But eventually, I wear them all down.
Yep.
Okay?
Because you're there every day.
Yes, and they see me, and they can feel my genuineness.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And my and I don't care what their job is, because I told them, I said, when they were talking about the COVID-19 vaccine, I said, I would rather they give that to the environmental services people who are cleaning the NICU and the MICU than for you guys to tell me it's time for me to go down and get my shot. And they said, shut up, Beverly. You going to go get that shot. Go get the shot. Yeah. Okay, so I went ahead and got the shot when they told me they got the shot, because I am seeing pregnant women who are high risk.
Right.
And my specialty is in the area of the fetus as the patient.
Yes, exactly.
And so,
I know you guys are doing surgeries there.
Yes, we are doing prenatal surgery before birth, correcting defects, doing all kind of interventional procedures. Mm-hmm. But be that as it may, I just felt like I was protecting myself enough that other people should have been vaccinated before me. But
I understand. The greater good.
I just said, sure. I'm going to do what you all tell me to do, but these are the people that I feel that are at worst risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every one of our men who's emptying a trash can.
Right. Okay? Essential workers.
Yes, exactly. And we are essential, but we never paid essentially.
That's
and
right.
And so no matter what institution I've been in, I've always made friends with whoever was in the cafeteria. They would look for me. And and my husband said, they always speak to you. And I said, they want people to know that they know me. And they know that I'm always going to speak back. Some of our people won't speak back. Mm, exactly. But a lot of times I speak to them before they even speak to me, because I identify with them. I don't care that I have on this white coat, you know, or whatever. But that is one of the stories of our race.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have to be really honest. Mm-hmm. And my husband and I will do, you know, the crabs in the barrel kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Talk about one starts to make it up and the others pull it back and whatever. Mm-hmm. Da, da, da. And like I said, I have moved on from that. And I think that a lot of my drive was hereditary. Mm-hmm. I think it must have come from my mom, who was like the driving force. My dad was very laid, way laid back, but my mom was the one that these children and are going to do what they're going to do, and I'm going to encourage them. Mm-hmm. So I told you about the groups of threes. That first three, the older one was inherently brilliant, but he ended up getting involved with the Commodores and dropping out of Tuskegee Institute and traveling to Europe and all these other places.
Just becoming
and
a famous person.
And then the Vietnam War came. And they made him come back to the state of Arkansas and drafted him. That's how he ended up getting out of the group.
Oh,
it was a holy mess. Mm-hmm. Mm,
wow.
The I was the middle one, but I was the more driven one, I think.
You're ready to work.
In the sense that I don't care if he's smarter than me, because he, my brother could do the physics and the chemistry and all that, and sometimes he wouldn't even have to open the chapter. You just had to talk to him, and he would sort of like absorb it.
He puts it together.
Me, I had to read it. I had to underline it. Uh-huh. I want to understand it. I want to do all of that. But I was a straight-A student.
Yeah.
he could have had it. Yeah, I was the one, because he you know, he would leave his book in the locker. I mean, crazy things like that.
As with anything, you know, it takes hard work and practice to hone the skills.
And then the younger one, the third one in that first group, he was sort of like an average student. He struggled and he got B's and C's and things like that. But my mom would make the biggest deal over his report card. Okay, because you know, this was expected of me. Yeah. So I was like, well, what?
This is a magic, mom.
Yeah, exactly. So that was my whole life story. But I think everybody in my family, they're proud of me. We all, you know, still communicate, still get along. We have family ventures. We have, for the COVID, you know, we have a big Zoom thing and everybody talks.
Yeah.
What's going on with so-and-so? And
doing
things
the
like
best
that.
We can.
Yeah, and we go to weddings and graduations and all those kinds of things for people and whatnot. But you know, again, from a financial perspective, you can imagine that, you know, I am, you know, at the pinnacle, But that was not the driving force for any of this. It was just, and I told them, I said, when I went in radiology, I didn't even know it was supposed to be lucrative. I just was doing, you know, I liked it. Yeah. I was stimulated by what was going on and to be able to tell people, this is what you need to do. And so the surgeons right now will
Travis
say,
calls him the coach.
Yeah,
radiologist is the coach.
Oh, yeah. That's what he they will say right now, if she tells you something, you can take it to the bank. Mm-hmm. And I keep telling them, I don't need any more praise. I don't need you to say all these things. Don't be doing this because the MFMs get mad. Okay. And other people, And everything becomes a struggle because they said, Dr. Coleman is going to do all of the first time evaluations of the patients. Mm-hmm. Okay. When the program first started 25 years ago, they came to Penn from San Francisco, which is where fetal therapy, quote unquote, was invented.
Okay.
And Dr. Scott Azik, who is the Surgeon General at CHOP right now, he loves me to death and he's always lauding me over other people. But that makes it hard for you. Like when you were, when I was in elementary school, you know, they would do that. You need to be doing what Beverly's doing. And you need, and in high school and stuff like that.
Or even
and
a residency, you, like you said, becoming chief resident.
It makes it
very
really political and it makes it tough. For people to use you as an example, and it's not necessarily in your best interest. Be that as it may, I have been driven to the point where I had a goal. I saw where I wanted to go, and I was going to do it, and I was determined not to let anybody stop me. And I didn't care if nobody black had ever done it before, whatever it was. It's time for somebody to do it.
Right.
Okay,
I heard
so we need to get this done.
100%.
Okay, tell me what I need to do to get this done. So I did not have the highest IQ of all of the kids in my family, but I think the thing that pushed me was that I was the one that was most driven. And people laugh about that doctor being away on a fishing trip thing, but that's the only that's what I think drove me because I kept saying that where are the MDs? Where is every What is going on? Why should this happen? And that kind of thing. And it's still happening right now today. Right. Okay?
Well, what I
the maternal death rate for black women.
How many times is it for other women of other nationalities?
Right. It is happening right now. And we still haven't corrected everything we need to correct.
That's so
but
true.
We can't give up.
No, we won't.
We just got to keep moving forward. Yeah.
And what I love about what I hear from you as a radiologist is just this love for people. You talk about those who should have first access to the vaccine. You talk about those who are underserved. You're talking about an underserved population.
Yes, exactly.
And now, and we need that passion. We need folks like you in leadership.
We do.
I mean, you are, I mean, we're going to talk about it, but the first African-American president of the American College of Radiology in 100 years of its existence. And to have someone at the
helm. And now they put me on the Centennial Committee. We want you to be on the Centennial Committee. I said, okay, I'll be on there.
See, saying yes, that's what she'll do.
But that's right. But my feeling is I may be the first, but I'm like Kamala Harris. I am not going to be the last.
I heard that.
Once I show them that we can do this, someone will come along. It may take 5 years, it may take 10 years, it may take 20 years. Maybe the next one will be a black male, but someone will have to come along.
Exactly.
Someone is going to eventually have to be chair of the board of CHOP. Highest position on the ACR is chairman of the board. And they've it took them forever to get a woman. And they have yet to have a person of color. The most important thing they've done in the American College of Radiology for a person of color is they gave the gold medal to William Allen. Who was the black radiologist, you guys know, at Howard University. He established the first radiologic technology school at Howard University.
Right. At Freedman's Hospital,
And if you look into his history, you should read some of his life story. When he had to go sit for the boards, he was the first person to ever sit for the board. They wouldn't let him ride the passenger elevator.
That's right.
He had to take the freight elevator. And there was trash on there. And he said he would never forget that smell for the rest of his life.
Wow.
But he went up there on that elevator and he took that exam and he passed it. And then it took forever for states to recognize it.
Right.
I will never forget when I took the American board exam and I eventually became an examiner on the boards for many years. And I have a lifetime service award from them. But I had a Caucasian Southerner who obviously did not want his hand to touch my hand.
Wow.
This was back in the day when it wasn't electronic.
This is in Louisville.
Yes.
I did.
And they passed, they passed the films to you.
Yes, exactly.
And they would sit behind you and pass the films forward. So his hand would be on the tip of the film on this end, and he would expect me to touch the tip of the film on that end. If my hand got too close to his hand, he would withdraw the hand, and the film would drop, and then he would pick it up and then hand it back to me.
That's a, what year is so this? This is like
when I took like my took my radiology board.
70s. Wow. Yeah.
So not only do you have to know the material,
it
know
was like
it cold.
Yeah.
You have to deal with
1978. This wasn't that,
it's not that long ago. Yeah.
Someone who doesn't want you to take the test doesn't want you to touch them.
Yeah.
Like how decreases your chances of passing.
Yeah.
It just
does. Exactly. And then what happened was that, you know, Penn, as you might imagine, had examiners.
Yes.
Okay. So Murray Delinka, who was our chief of musculoskeletal, he rode the plane back. Okay. And he was on the plane, and people were saying, who was that black girl? Okay. And they were talking, and he realized it was me.
That's right.
And so then he owned up to me.
Wow.
And not only that, he came back. He was a Jewish guy, but he came back to the hospital and told the rest of the people at Penn that everybody on the plane that had examined at the boards was talking about the black girl and who was she and what institution was she from, because they're not supposed to know where you're from,
right? No.
In order to keep the bias out
of
the exam
and
everything else. That's so correct. They didn't know whether I was from Howard or Meharry. Where they didn't know where I was from.
It's either Howard or Meharry.
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's what they were thinking even back in 1970.
Right.
78. That's right. But I graduated medical school 7, but this is 1978. But but the bottom line is he owned up that I was from Philadelphia, and he had this broad grin on his face, and he was coming back telling everybody.
Yeah.
But it has been a long, hard struggle.
It has.
And the struggle is still there. It's just manifests itself in different ways.
Exactly.
Now.
Talk about that a little bit. How does it manifest itself, you think?
Well, I mean, I'm no longer young enough to know what all of the students and the residents are going through, but I see them, and they see me, and I you know, offer to talk to them, and sometimes they don't often come to complain about a particular staff member someone like that. But you know that you're doing this podcast because equity and diversity is still a main issue in this country.
So,
and you can imagine that still in the 2020s, there are episodes, not just with patients, but with trainees. Like, you know, back in the day, I think I've had one episode in my whole life where the guy obviously did not want me taking care of his wife.
But
I usually take people off guard. You know, I'll go in smiling, effusive, and I'm Dr. Coleman, and how did I, how are you doing today, da, 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 da. And it puts them, even now, in a certain position. I do that when I walk in the room now, because and a lot of times the stenographers will prep them before I get there.
Yes.
Dr. Coleman is the chief, every patient is scanned by a doctor here at CHOP. They don't do that in the real world because it's too expensive. But here we have the time and energy, and they want a medical doctor to sign off, not just on looking at the images, but on exactly what's wrong with this baby and what's going on with you. So they give them a prep before I get in the room. I walk into the room, I open the door, and I say, because they say we're not patient-facing, I say, hi, I'm Dr. Coleman, I'm the radiologist.
Yeah, yeah.
I am going to check the baby. Every patient gets checked by a doctor here, and then I'm going to talk with your maternal fetal medicine specialist, and then they're going to discuss everything with you. And I say to them, we do all of the pregnant moms like a jigsaw puzzle. They take a piece from me. If you have fetal MR, they take a piece from MR. If you have echocardiography, they talk to the cardiologist, they take a piece from them. They put everything together, and then when you sit down and have the family meeting, your husband or your mother, whoever's accompanying you, before COVID we could have
many people in the room.
Now we only allow one other person. They can only have one other person. Most of the times it's the spouse. Sometimes it's the boyfriend or the mother if dad is working or and keeping the other two kids and something like that. But you allow one other person in a room, and that's it.
Yeah.
And we are all masked up. I have to wear goggles when I'm in the room now. Mm-hmm. We relax that when things look like they were coming down, and then they started to go back up to you, and they said, that's cool. You got to put your goggles back on again.
That's
put your goggles back on. But I understand that life is a challenge, and it is also a privilege, and nobody said it was going to be a rose garden.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So everything that you do as far as overcoming any particular incident or episode or any unpleasantry in your life is going to make you stronger.
Absolutely.
So I am a cup is half full person.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, yes.
And that's sort of the way I look at it. And I feel like some days, why in the world did this happen to me? But that's the way I am. So when Dr. Azik is up there crowing about me, the MFMs know that he will not let them do the first evaluation. And when he came from San Francisco, what he said is, I'm used to working for radiologists. I work with Roy Philly. What, you know, what's going on here at Penn? And I explained to him what the political environment was at Penn, how interested I was in prenatal diagnosis, anomalies before birth, but how the MFM specialty was developed.
Yes.
And it came along when there was originally only, just simple OBGYN, and that we walked in the door of a lot of hospitals saying, we're going to take over all of the fetal ultrasound. And I said, they did that here at Penn. And some places like Harvard, Brigham, and Women's, they split the lab, and the radiologists run one day, and the MFMs run another day, and the MFMs are smart enough to know if it's something wild and they don't know what's going on, call the radiologist to help you and stuff like that.
Right.
So when he came, he sent... He would send one first eval to me and one to them. One to me, one to them. It took him less than 6 months, 3 months. And it was like, he called the big meeting. He said, Dr. Coleman would be doing all of the first time evaluation.
That's right. That's
and that was it. Yeah. Because he went in to do surgery and the catheter was not where they told him he was supposed to put it.
Mm-hmm.
The diagnosis was not what it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I need to be as correct can be before I go in if I'm going to do prenatal surgery.
Absolutely.
And the way this works is you do a low hysterotomy, it's like the bikini type incision.
Mm-hmm.
You bring out the part of the baby that's involved. If it's a spina bifida, you untangle the cord, you close the muscle and skin, you put the little buns back in, and you sew the mom up. She's in the hospital 3, 4, 5 days, and then she goes home.
It's amazing.
And we go to Ronald McDonald House, but they have to make sure that she comes back to CHOP to deliver. And we've gotten so comfortable with it. We used to never let them go home. Now they'll let them go somewhere and then come back. And, as long as they're near there to delivery time.
Wow.
But
how many cases would you say you've been involved with since you started?
Thousands. Like I said, the program started. It's 25. It was 25 years old, and we couldn't celebrate because of COVID.
Yeah.
So we're going to have this big, grandiose celebration.
Yeah.
Generally, we have what we call a family reunion every June.
Okay.
We have treated patients from all 50 states and multiple countries.
Oh, I'm sure from all over the world. Yeah.
Yes. And the kids come back. We will have 2,000-3,000 people at the family reunion in June, and they have name tags that are colored, so the hearts will be red.
Yeah.
And GU Chack will be green, and GI will be blue, and CNS will be yellow, and things like that. And then a lot of the parents, what we do is once we've done a therapy, sometimes we will connect parents up who are going through what another parent had already gone through.
Very
so they
important. Yeah.
They meet other people, they become friends, they talk to one another, things like that.
So it becomes a bond.
It becomes a bond. You've got twins, I've got twins, what did you have? 20/20 transfusion syndrome. So we do all of that. So when they come back for the reunion, everybody is just, you know, it's a whole day thing. The firemen come, there's rides, and there's cotton candy and candy apples, and there's games and
the most
face
important thing
painting.
The kids are there.
It's a happy day.
And the kids are there.
Yes.
And you get, and not every kid is walking, but a lot of the kids that would have been Jerry Lewis kids are walking with no braces, no assistance, no nothing.
Yeah.
And I look at them like, oh my gosh, that's so and so. She was my
and
then they will come up to me, you know, like and we have gotten a lot of the kids interested in medicine.
I'm sure.
Because they know what they've been through. So some of them want to be doctors and things like that.
And they can do it.
And
absolutely.
Yeah. And we have pictures of them and stories. I mean, it's just a phenomenal program. It's the largest fetal therapy program in the world. But now people are branching out. So, you know, they started one in Denver. Mm-hmm. And now that we have Children's Hospital built a suite where the pregnant mothers can be delivered in the hospital and they can go down the corridor and see their baby. You know, at Harvard, for example, you got the Children's Hospital. Yeah. And then you got the Lion Inn Hospital where mom's one place and the baby gets transferred to the NICU someplace else. Well, our moms can go up to the NICU and see their kids because they're all in the same hospital.
Yes.
And the desire is so great that recently we expanded because we didn't have enough beds. Mm-hmm. And they wanted everybody to have their own bed, and they were putting two moms together and things like that. So, yeah, it is a huge program. I think that it will continue to grow. And I tell people, I said, take the politics aside. Take all of the egos out of this. Mm-hmm. If you just do the very best you can do for the patient, all of the rest of this stuff will come automatically.
Absolutely.
Exactly.
So absolutely. It'll take for care the of itself. Second year in a row, they have this double press Ganey Award. CHOP has never had any department get these two awards, two different medals from press Ganey in two different categories. And now the Center for Fetal Diagnosis and Treatment has gotten the two awards last year, and this year we got the two awards.
Wow, congratulations.
So we had to take our picture with the CEO, Madeline Bell, and all the people and everything.
Oh, that's so nice.
But I am very passionate. You can probably hear that from my
voice. Absolutely, I
love about
this.
What I do, because I think that you are in medicine to make a difference.
Uh-huh.
And you can come at it from various perspectives, and there are people who are doing incredible oncologic research and things like that, and they're going to discover the cure for this or that or whatever. But to treat life before birth, I think, is so fascinating.
That is.
And we are constantly coming up with new procedures and new things to do to try to fix this and fix that. We're even doing research on gene therapy.
Wow.
And we're working with all kinds of new ideas, elastography and ultrasound contrast and things like that. So CHOP is famous for separating conjoined twins.
Yeah.
So we had a pair separated yesterday. Friday. So the reason I work Friday is that I'm pushing my young associates forward.
Okay.
Because, you know, I'm in my 70s. I can't keep doing this. And they don't want to let me go. I'm trying to push the young people forward. So he was in the OR giving ultrasound contrast to the babies to see where is the best place to make the incision to separate the liver portions that they share.
Okay.
They had two different stomachs, two different bladders. Everybody had their kidneys. Everybody had their extremities. But from the thorax down, the most common thoracoemphalopagus, their hearts were close together, and you could see their pericardiums touching, but none of the muscles were shared.
But there was a point.
So they knew how they were going to get through the chest. They were trying to figure out how they were going to split the bowel and the liver.
So
they gave ultrasound contrast, and you could see the portal and the hepatic veins and everything. And figure out, okay, which plane should I go in to make this?
That's so
and you were integral in planning that. That's wonderful.
So it is such fascinating work.
What are you most proud of? Your list of accomplishments.
Oh,
so many.
So many.
I am just proud that I can do what I do and that I can give back and that I can be a face. I can be a face of radiology.
Wonderful.
A face of radiology. So my husband, you know, he knows the editor at the Philadelphia Tribune. So they called to interview me and all that. And they decided that in his boule, they want us to be the first STEM couple, because he's a dentist and I'm a radiologist, whatever. But I want to get as many children of color interested in science as we can get.
I love that.
Okay? And I don't want us to be looked upon as entertainers and sports figures, and I know we can do that tremendously and all
but if
that.
If you can do that, you can also do
this. But there are other
things
that we can do.
Absolutely.
And so that's what keeps me going. And I told them, I said, you know what? One of the things I found out in the midst of this pandemic is that I'm not good to be at home trying to figure out, okay, Hey, and I'm not into watching soap operas. I can only read so many books.
Right.
I need to be out there among the people. I'm a real social animal. So yeah. I said, I will make Dr. Adzik happy and let him know that I'm not leaving tomorrow or this year. My young associate went up for promotion, and he was approved effective as of July 1st, 2022.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I told them, if I can make it to 75 and I'm still okay, I may use that year as the going out year. This August 15th, I turned 73. But I said, I don't know. I'm just taking each day as it comes. And I said, you guys have to realize that me being here is what it is, and I won't make you any real promises, but I'll stay as long as I can stay. But I am very, very comfortable that the young people are moving along at a pace that I am happy with.
Okay.
We just had another young man that's going to start the 1st of July when he finishes fellowship, because the one young man that I had pegged had to go back to Delaware. Mm-hmm. And so we were down a person, but you know, I want to leave the whole program from a radiological perspective mm-hmm. in an excellent position mm-hmm. so they can just keep doing what we've always been doing mm-hmm. to the best of our ability.
Absolutely.
And we are right the vast majority of the time, which is how I got the job. And mm-hmm. that's why I tell them, I said, you have to keep on being right. I said, don't just look at that image and say, I think that's okay. Put that on your list. So I tell them, I said, give me a check mark. Tell me everything you want me to look after. Mm-hmm. Ask me any questions. So I still teach all day, every day.
Yeah.
And I am very respected by my sonographers who do all of the preliminary scanning. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. They have learned a tremendous amount. All of them love what they do.
Yes.
They're happy to work with me. Mm-hmm. And they are proud of being in the program. And we're just going to keep doing
keep
what we
going.
Do
yes. yeah.
to the advantage of the patients. And a significant percentage of our patients are of color.
Yep,
and
sure.
we don't care in the CFDT if you have money, if you don't have money.
Mm-hmm.
We have tremendous benevolence for many people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can take people that are on Medicaid
yes.
and do everything that we would do if they had Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Yes.
That's the way
Much
we handle
appreciated.
It. So,
wow.
it doesn't matter.
Yeah, they get the same care.
We offer it to everyone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. That's
and that's another beautiful part of the program.
It's amazing. It just makes your life just more like fulfilled when you're
yes.
able to like kind of do things like
yes.
that and be able
if
to.
If you're doing, and that's what I told Aaron. I said, you have to find a career that will make you want to get up.
Yes.
Day.
Yes, that's true.
And excited to go there.
Yeah.
There may be tough days.
And every day is not going to be a holiday.
No.
But that's okay. You take it for what it brings.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you have to do.
Exactly.
So she is excellent and top-notch at her craft. And she absorbed
yes.
that lesson from me. And now I'm trying to give it to the little ones.
Yeah.
You know, it has to be something that you care about. And
yes.
that you are passionate about, that you really, really want to do.
Absolutely.
And that way you will do it to the very best of your ability.
Yeah.
I have no doubt that the college is headed in a great direction.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
You're gonna you know, work on health disparities and making sure we are a face and improving equity, diversity, and inclusion.
Exactly.
I just think it's great.
I think wonderful. I think I speak for like a lot of people when we saw that you were elected and we saw like the articles about it. I think that, you know, it just gives us like a sense of pride. It gives us like a sense of, you know, just it just feels great to see someone
yes.
like us doing this.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it also gives us like a lot of motivation to like continue.
Exactly.
You know, every day
exactly.
is a little, it's tough for everybody.
Yep.
So
that's
like,
right.
you know, to know that, you know, you've been through an entire
yes.
career and you've
yes.
made it to this point.
And if I can do it, you can.
Absolutely.
That's the message.
Yeah.
That's the message. You want someone to look at her and say, I can do that.
Yes.
I want to do that. I will do that.
Yes.
And so, you know, I don't even know if I'll be alive to see the next black president or the next black chair of the Board of Chancellors. I don't even know when that's going to happen. It took a long, long time to
yeah.
get here.
Yeah,
okay?
It did.
A long time. Almost okay. 100 years ago. Exactly.
Absolutely.
But we're here now. So
mm-hmm.
we're not looking backwards.
No, not
at
all.
We are here now.
That's
we are here now and we're moving forward.
Exactly. And
that's
I was gonna say, like I think a lot of what you've done you might not see. You might have radiologists who are like kind of considering becoming like the head of their hospital And now they see you doing it, and they're like, you know what? Let me go for this.
Absolutely.
You know, so you're not necessarily going to see that thing happening, but it is happening.
The positivity you're spreading is exponential.
Exactly. No,
you probably won't see it. Yeah, but it's there.
That
I know
is
it's
great.
There. It's
it definitely is. Yes.
Thank you for telling me. Yes. It is good to know. You never ever really know what impact you might have until someone gives their testimony.
Exactly.
And so I am out there for people to see me.
Yes.
And I am very, very visible. Yes. And I'm going to continue to be so.
Yes.
Because I think that's important.
Oh, it is. It is. Just
that we're out there.
Yes. Just for everyone. And I think even like you said in the cafeteria or seeing like people who are working like custodial services in the hospital, you know, the fact that they can talk to you means they can go talk to their children and be like, hey, you can do this because I know someone doing this. And I talk to her every day, and she is the nicest person I know. So you can do this, you know.
And if they came up to me and say, would you talk to my daughter? I would say, absolutely.
Yes.
Let's sit down and have lunch.
That's why we
that's
do
right.
it.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. Because somebody is always going to be the first, but it is what it is.
Yes,
okay?
Exactly.
And the fact that they can see you.
Yes.
Okay. They have done studies on the, diversity and inclusion to the point where they talk about people, patients of color, mm-hmm. with physicians of color.
Yes.
Okay?
Oh, yeah.
And they have documented, and it is true, that they do well.
Yes.
Okay? And you want them to feel like you care about mm-hmm. them.
Oh,
okay?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
That's so
true. And if you have somebody that, you know, doesn't want to touch your hand or, you know, is looking at the sheet that's covering you and all this other kind of stuff and not treating you with the dignity and respect that you deserve, that is not a good thing.
Huge it's barriers not. To your healthcare
exactly.
when you have that sort of encounter.
Yes.
And it's such an honor and a privilege to walk into a room and to see a patient light up when they see you.
Yes, they do.
It is.
Yes. When I say, I'm Dr. Coleman, I'm the radiologist, some of them will beam.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're going to do the procedure?
Yes.
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 Yep.
Exactly.
Some of them will say, And then, and I'll say, did the sonographer tell you I was coming? Oh, yeah.
Unspoken.
Yes.
It's unspoken. But, you know, our wives are both internal medicine doctors.
Oh, okay.
So they
fantastic.
Have that, so they always explain.
So
that, you
they,
know, they
have
the same
experiences
thing.
That they can tell you
oh,
about as
exactly.
well.
So
yeah.
they get that same feeling when they see, you know, patients, and they, you know, when they're told, you know, they're going to come into the room, and then you can just tell.
Yes. Sometimes you know. They're very surprised to see you. Now, as the years have passed, I get that less and less and less. Years ago, it was like almost every week, almost every day. Now it's just. They just see me walking back and forth through the dressing room. Yeah, and then I'll see them, you know, months later, and they'll say, hi, how you doing? You know, because they remember me.
Yes.
And they have a Caucasian couple from North Carolina. I can tell you this story. Mm-hmm. They were told that their son had Down syndrome, high risk.
Okay.
And they came to me, and I said, no, that's not true. And I said, don't let anybody tell you that. This is not the case. I said, this baby is going to be totally fine. And I said, even if they hint, it is still a possibility. Just ignore them and remember what I'm telling you this day. And I never saw them again after that day. And every patient who comes to see us is assigned a nurse coordinator.
Okay.
And every patient has to go through a genetic analysis. So I found out that they had been looking for me, and they didn't have my email, and they didn't know how to contact me.
Yes.
But they found their nurse coordinator, and they sent the baby picture, and they said, we wanted Dr. Coleman to know that we named our son after her.
Wow. Really?
And his name is Cole. C-O-L-E is his first name.
Wow.
In North Carolina, no less. Okay? And he's Caucasian. And this year, they sent me a picture. He's like 7 or 8 years old now.
Wow,
so I have a baby
sweet.
Picture of him. And then I have, he is so handsome. And I have a picture of him now. And I said, this is my namesake.
Yes.
And we are a different race. We are both Southerners. Okay.
Uh-huh, that's true.
Different states, but different race in a different time in the country. They didn't have to do this.
No.
And even if they decided to do it, they didn't have to search for me let me know that they had done it.
Exactly.
But they did. And I showed his picture on some of my lectures.
That's wonderful. Say, that's so great. Yeah,
these are the things that can happen.
Yes.
When you put all of your stuff aside and do what is best for the
patient. Can do what's best for the patient.
And that's why the surgeons love me so, because you know they'll say, is this bowel dilated? And I'll say, you know, we don't really have good numbers for bowel. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to sit down and measure all the segments of the bowel and come up with a new range of numbers. Mm-hmm. The articles are all old and they're back in the 80s and the 70s. Mm-hmm. And we did, Beverly, is this? And I said, yes, it's normal. So then I have another couple, Caucasian, three boys. Mm-hmm. And the surgeon put me under the microscope. And he said, Beverly, is this bowel normal? I said, absolutely. And I said, you tell this normal. I said, the numbers are bigger than what I have. But I said, I stood there and I watched it and I looked at the meconium percolate through it. Mm-hmm. And I said, all of this stuff about this kid's going to have surgery when it's born and a yada, 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 it's not true.
Yeah.
This bowel is going to be normal. Mm-hmm. We just don't have good nomograms to compare it to.
Yes.
And the baby was born and she sent a picture back of her two sons holding the little baby. And she said, I need you to show this to Dr. Coleman. I wanted to see. We didn't have to have any surgery.
The bowel
we
was normal.
The bowel is normal.
Being definitive, patient care.
Yes.
Those are lessons.
That's right.
You know, being a radiologist, be helpful.
Exactly. And you can't always tiptoe. Sometimes you got to
come
step
down
out
on
there.
It. That's
exactly.
right.
Even if you're not 100% sure, you're right.
Yeah.
You say, in my gut, bowel is normal.
Go with that.
The numbers are big. Mm-hmm. It looks dilated, but it's moving. Everything looks fine.
Yeah.
The wall is okay. There's no ascites. I'm sticking my neck out that this bowel is normal. I said, Scott, you're putting me on. You know, you were giving me a hard time. But I said, my vote is that this bowel is normal. You tell them it's normal.
I love that, Dr. Carl.
That's the nuance and soft skills that you have to learn in radiology.
Yes,
I think
that's
part
it's
of
hard.
The training. It's
yes,
tough.
It is.
And
it
you
takes some experience.
It is. It is.
Definitely
it is.
A lot of experience.
And you'll put your toe in the water.
Yes.
But eventually you're going to put your foot in the water and you're going to have to jump in.
That's right. And it may not always be warm.
And you got to do it. and you know, it may not be pleasant.
Right.
It might be the polar bear plunge.
Yes.
But you got to take it. Okay, you got to take it.
That's right.
And that's my attitude.
Yeah.
And it has served me well.
Obviously. Well.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yes, we really appreciate it. We really, really appreciate it.
This has been great.
You're welcome. I mean, it's tough on you guys to drive all the way from D.C. and then have to drive all the way back.
Worth
it.
No,
many times
over. To meet a legend?
That's right.
I wanted this to be worth your while.
Oh,
and it has been.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you one more question.
Okay.
So we had a question come in from a viewer, basically, and they were saying, what would you tell someone who's in medical school now that's having a rough time?
To persevere.
Yes.
Exactly. There are no promises.
Mm-hmm.
Medical school is always going to be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that you decided to go into it means that you made a huge step.
Mm-hmm.
Because you could have decided to get an MBA. That's 1 year.
Yeah, that's true.
You could have decided to go to law school. That's 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you've got medical school. You've got internship. You've got residency. Then you've got specialties for fellowships. You're dedicating 10 years of your life.
Yeah.
I don't care how hard it is. Yeah. Never give up.
That's right.
Yes.
That you have to persevere.
Yes.
Mister, it is difficult because they want to weed out the people who have what it takes.
Hey.
Okay.
Tell
and I've always had that idea.
Me too.
Why did I have to take a foreign language at Vassar in order to get into medical school?
Right.
And Beverly, why did you pick German? Because they said, you can't do Spanish, okay, or French, you know, because I had done 4 years of French in high school.
Oh, see.
They said, these are the options.
Oh,
you get
man.
German, you get Latin. That's the way it was.
Are you serious?
Yes.
You couldn't, the French that you would prepare for, you couldn't.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
man.
I was like, oh, that's such a rough language. I don't even like doing the words, but I said, I'll do it.
Yeah.
I'll do it. And I did it.
Yes.
Okay. I got a C. I don't like C's, but I got a C in German. I
you
said, I
done.
Don't care.
There
that I didn't fail it.
You got
and
it
that's
done.
The most important thing. I'm not failing anything.
There you go.
Okay. I got through it, but I hated it.
Oh,
and I
so
said,
funny.
Oh, to speak those words. And it didn't matter if I spoke well or, and this is another thing I'll tell you about Vassar. You could ace the test. And then the teacher would say, I didn't give you a name. I said, well, why not? And she'll say, because of your classroom participation. And you didn't realize that, you know, because of course, going there, you know, it was culture shock.
It's different.
So you were afraid to speak up in the first few years.
Exactly.
Yeah, by the time I got to be a senior, I didn't give a crap. Okay? Because I'm getting out of here and I'm getting my degree.
Right.
But in the first few years, as a freshman, a sophomore, you didn't feel like they cared what you thought about the author was thinking.
Okay? Absolutely.
I had one teacher accuse me of plagiarism. She said, "I can't believe you wrote this." And I said, "You told me dig deep, to do all this other stuff, and you didn't like the first, you know, report that I had written up for you. So I delved into this character and I did this and I did all this and I wrote everything for you. And then for you to think that I didn't write it," I got her fired.
Oh,
I got her fired.
All right.
But, these things keep popping in my head. I'm never going to be able to tell you all of the stories, anybody who's having difficulty in medical school right now, you take a deep breath, you get a nap, you do whatever you have to do, and you wake up the next morning and you tackle the problem. Okay, and
that's
what you got to do.
Don't stop.
Don't stop.
Get it.
You both said your wives are internal medicine.
Yeah,
they didn't quit.
No.
And you tell your kids, don't quit, or your relatives, or whoever, your friend's child.
Yeah, always,
anybody.
Exactly.
Yeah,
don't get outworked.
No matter what happens, don't be discouraged.
Exactly.
There's an old hymnal that goes, "Don't be discouraged."
Yes.
Gotta keep going.
Perfect. Well, thank you so much for making the time. We really appreciate it. Yes.
Please subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes or wherever you get your pods.
Are we at the end? Yes, we're at the end. So this is going to give you a chance to get back before it gets too dark.
There you go.
2:25.
And you got the grandbabies.
Exactly. Yes. Did you see them peeping around here?
Out of the corner of my eye. Yes. I don't want to keep you.
We'll let you handle that.
I'm Mimi. And I spoil them.
That's right.
Okay. And
you got to enjoy them.
They can't be without me for so long. They tolerate my husband. They want their Mimi.